Hello and welcome to The Climate Briefing, a podcast from Chatham House. I'm joined in the studio today by three of the fantastic guests who I've just been sharing a round table with at the Chatham House Energy Transitions Conference. We've been talking about behaviour change and also demand reduction in the context of energy transitions. And this is something that came up a lot in the conference over the last 2 days. So behaviour change is a vital piece of the energy transition puzzle, both on its own in terms of how we act, but also in terms of its interplay with the technologies of transition. So whether we adopt, advocate for, and whether we accept different technologies. Over the last 2 days, we've heard from some brilliant speakers. Rachel Kite, for example, talked about the fact that a lot of the low-hanging fruit of the energy transition has already been taken, and that tougher elements of the transition, such as behaviour change, are now starting to bite. We also heard from Alan Whitehead MP, the Shadow Minister for Energy Security, about how we need much more concentration on the demand side, particularly efficiency in homes. We should also note that at COP28, 124 countries committed to double their energy efficiency by 2030. And homes will be important in achieving this in many countries. We heard from Lucy Yu of Octopus Energy about how we need to have conversations about optimising demand for variable generation to get more renewables onto the grid faster, and also about Octopus's pilot demand flexibility service, a trial which was strikingly successful with reductions of up to 40% of consumption seen, cumulatively comparable to the output of a small power plant. Yet, political reticence remains. So, as Rachel Kite said, politicians are uncomfortable with honest conversations with the public about the changes needed. And Lucy told us of what I'm coining as the Tesla thermostat paradox, where people strongly oppose the loss of autonomy in driverless cars, but expect home energy efficiency to be delegated to the machines. In her keynote address to the conference yesterday, Claire Coutinho, the Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero here in the UK, made scant reference to behaviour change, but instead talked about the UK's $20 billion of investment in carbon capture and storage research, which, together with supply-side innovation, has been left holding the carbon budget baby. So to grapple with this thorny and contentious issue with me today, I'm delighted to welcome to the studio Professor Felix Kreitzig, head of the IPCC Working Group on Land Use, Infrastructure and Transport, and Chair of Sustainability Economics at the Technical University of Berlin. Welcome, Felix.
Thank you. For the last IPCC report, we wrote a new chapter that has never been before on demand and services and social aspects, and it's very broadly capturing behavioral change. So what did we actually find here? Two key messages. First, like demand side issues can capture 40 to 70% of greenhouse gas emission reductions until 2050. So that's a very big number. It does not involve supply side change in terms of the energy system. So we can do a lot here. That's the first good news. The second one is actually most of these measures, but not all, improve well-being. So they make life better for people. So that's also very good news. So we should go into that, but of course, it's not easy. What are these demand-side measures now? We basically talk about three classes: social, cultural issues, we talk about infrastructures, and we talk about technology adoption. Technology adoption, the big items here are electric vehicles. And in housing, it's mostly insulation, it's heat pumps, and it's also smart home energy systems. We have like acceptance issues in all of that. There's also liquidity issue. It costs a lot to finance them front up, usually not over lifetime. So we're actually doing cost savings over lifetime. But at the beginning, consumers need to put actual cash into their hands. That's one issue. And for electric vehicles, we understand that people don't trust them, but once they try, they like them. So it's about like letting them try. That's a major intervention to get into that. For housing systems, you can't just try because you really install a system. So that's much more about descriptive norms. You hear from neighbors that they're using them. You trust your neighbors and friends, and then you're going into them yourselves. The other two items, the biggest one is actually in the social cultural domain diet shift, that you go to more plant-based diets. It's huge. I didn't believe the numbers when I've seen them, but that's like a big, big thing to go forward. And the other thing is infrastructures. Infrastructures can be seen as choice architectures. That's what behavioral scientists are talking about. But infrastructures in cities are, that's what urban planners' domain. So urban planners talk about how to design cities, and these are basically giant choice architectures. And we have to go into them to see like how to make cities actually for better life quality of life, but then of course to decrease emissions in transport system and eventually also buildings, because transport and building are very much related to each other in cities.
Thank you, Felix. So one of the issues with behavior change is the number, as you say, the breadth of different behaviors that are covered. So we have everything from the food on our plates to the cars we drive to the cities we live in. My next guest, Toby Park, has lots of experience of understanding these behaviours and delving into them and thinking also about how they might be changed. So Toby is the Principal Advisor and Head of Energy, Environment and Sustainability at the Behavioural Insights team. Welcome, Toby.
Thank you very much. Yes, and that breadth of behaviours covers something like 62% of the emissions cuts we need to achieve to reach net zero by 2050. The lion's share of that is technology adoption behaviours, something like 53%, and the other 9% is more like lifestyle changes, so changes in diet, reduced aviation demand, etc.
It's a really interesting point that even when people are wedded to these technological solutions, you still need behaviour change to make them work.
You do. So there's this intersection between technology and behaviour. We can't have one without the other when it comes to adoption. That stat is a UK stat, but the global picture is not so very different. And people would generally do what is easy, convenient, what is affordable or cheap, and what is appealing to them. And it might be appealing for a range of reasons, maybe because it improves their life in some way, makes them more comfortable, it serves their needs, maybe it's aspirational in some way or jives with their identity and so on. But the challenge is often sustainable choices are not easy or cheap or particularly appealing. And so we need a broad range of sort of interventions and policy initiatives to change that. So if we take just one example, like heat pumps, for example, are they cheap? No, they're significantly more costly than a gas boiler to install. Are they convenient? Absolutely not. If your gas boiler breaks in the middle of the winter, you could get a replacement probably in 48 hours when you need one. In contrast, a heat pump might take a few months. You need a home survey. And so on. It's a very complex process.
I'm living that nightmare at the moment. My boiler is about 20 years old. And every time I walk past it, I think, don't break, because I really want to get a heat pump. But there's so much that needs to happen first for that to work.
Right. And you'd be better off preparing in advance so you're not having to do that in a rush, because it can't happen in a rush if it's your first time getting a heat pump. There are things that need to be done, plumbing changed, etc. And are they attractive even? Well, a lot of people would say no. These sort of more negative narratives around heat pumps are certainly overblown, although not entirely false in certain situations. But for instance, people tend to perceive them as noisy, ugly. They believe that they won't necessarily work at low outdoor temperatures, which of course is not true. The Nordic countries have got millions of heat pumps and they work just fine. But nonetheless, these negative perceptions do persist. So they're not appealing to people, they're not cheap, and they're not convenient. So that's obviously a big problem. So as I say, we need a wide range of policy and sort of technological advancement and so on to really tip the scales in favour of these technologies and these green choices. And that's hopefully what we're going to talk about.
So turning to my final guest, Dr. Christina Dembski is Deputy Director of the Centre for Climate Change and Social Transformation, or CAST, at the University of Bath. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you very much for having me. So at CAST, we have been researching the kinds of social transformations that are required for climate change for 5 years. And we're about to launch our key message report next week. And I think our main message really is to put people at the heart of climate action, and that there are lots of different things that need to happen to enable that, to enable and to kind of change widespread support that we see for climate action into actually lifestyle changes. There are probably three things that we need. One is a stronger behaviour change policies along the lines of what's already been discussed. They need to, you know, things need to be cheaper, easier, more convenient. They also need to kind of happen at times when people are open to change, like you were just saying, when the boiler breaks, it needs to be easy for you to find information, and it needs to all be in place for you to actually get your heating working again with a different kit, essentially. But we also find that public support is contingent on there being evidence of strong kind of government support for some of these changes. So what we also need is broader public engagement and broad public involvement in the decisions that are made across scales. So at city level, perhaps, at national level, but also in local communities. And I suppose perhaps thirdly, although some people might lump this in together with public engagement more broadly, is that we need more conversations. And this isn't just a UK issue. This also exists in other countries. We need conversations about what it means to reduce carbon emissions for us as a society. And we need leaders to step up and create narratives that are more positive, but also realistic about change. Mm-hmm. And then I think we might have a chance at getting people on board or translating that widespread support that exists generally into specific action.
I think it's important to remember that this isn't an ideological point. It's something that governments have in fact committed to under the Paris Agreement. So that often under attended to Article 12 of the Paris Agreement, signatory governments committed to enhance climate change education, training, public awareness, public participation and public access to information, recognising the importance of these steps with respect to enhancing actions on climate change. So this is something governments have signed up for. I'd be interested to hear to what extent in your work you see this happening either in the UK or in other countries.
One example are certainly citizens' councils, where citizens are asked to participate and not only to participate, but actually come up with some advice. And what's interesting in here is that it really works in terms of that the deliberation makes to come to sound decisions. So in Germany, there is very strong aversion against policies against cars. That's how it's seen, like when it comes to every kind of transport climate policy. And also citizens are mostly against. But if you have a representative sample that discusses for 3 months these issues, they come up actually with reasonable solutions, including issues like congestion charging, which are seen like as adversive to cars in other contexts. But after some deliberation, where the facts come on the table and the benefits of these policies, there's more agreement on those. So I think there's actually potential for this kind of active participatory process to become more institutionalized.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I think there has been a shift, what the OECD calls the deliberative wave. There's loads of interest now in these deliberative processes of engaging people. I mean, they can be done poorly or very well, depending on what your goals are. But I think we've used deliberative methods in our research for a really long time. And absolutely, I think, you know, a lot of the times when decision makers come to view these processes, they, like politicians, for example, they are surprised to see how reasonable people can be. But also people who are in these processes, they, I think, feel a sense of collective efficacy that people, they understand that people also have similar concerns to them and that they're willing to try and find solutions and that together we can do it. So there are some real strengths to these processes. You know, they're not easy to do. And there's a question about what comes out of them or how they're used in relation to other evidence or data or factors in decision making. But absolutely, I think there has been an increase in using them, and I think that's probably a positive step.
There's more insights coming on one issue. People always believe that they there support climate action, but others don't.
Yeah.
So there's this bias, and if this becomes clearer also for policymakers that there is a lot of support, that could actually help.
I'm always really interested in the citizens' assembly type approaches, but I do worry about the research effect within those, because as people engage in that group with others, the process is deliberative. People learn more about the issues that they're being asked to make decisions on. So within that process, they essentially become expert themselves. And often through that process, their views change. How possible do you think it is to upscale that process to wider society? Or do you think it's kind of a function of those deliberative research projects?
You're right. In a sense, going through the experience of being part of a deliberative process or a citizens' assembly is almost a sort of behaviour change intervention in itself. You come out a slightly different person than you went in often. That's not necessarily their primary objective, of course. They're not set up to try and change the attendees' views, rather to elicit a broad spectrum of views and try and reach some kind of consensus around what should be done. And I think there are other ways of sort of engaging the public more broadly. Of course, you know, the main point of those citizens' assemblies is to create a mandate for policy action and a particular flavour of policy action. When it comes to informing and supporting the wider public to make green choices, for example, and that is something the UK government has committed to within its net zero strategy. In practical terms, that means things like labelling often, as well as sort of wider educational efforts and so on. So your initial question was, is the government or governments doing enough of this? I mean, obviously it could be doing much, much more, but there are commitments in place to better inform the public through things like labelling to enable those green choices to happen. And of course, that in itself is not going to be a massive game changer. We know, for instance, from looking at the evidence on calorie labels, that that does have a modest impact, but it can have quite interesting indirect impacts as well. So it's not just that you're trying to encourage the consumer to choose healthier, or in this case, more sustainable products. It's also that by sort of deshrouding those attributes of a product or a service, you might also encourage the suppliers or the manufacturers to start greening their products as well. Because of course, you know, greenwash is a huge problem. And as a consumer, it's very hard to know which is or which isn't a green product. We tend to just go off our intuition or the dodgy marketing claims, or is the packaging the right kind of hue of green and brown, then it must be sustainable. If there was a reliable indication on the label, all of a sudden we don't need to rely on those imperfect intuitions. Like, we can just look at the label. And so there are these sort of other indirect benefits, I think, of these sort of labeling and outreach and communication and education efforts beyond just sort of discrete behavior change.
So there's one aspect beyond participation, which may be interesting and more scalable, that's agency. And what Toby just mentioned is a good example in terms of that you enable people to make decisions by giving them the information. That's one way to see it. But it can be possibly also scaled to black housing, like you enable people to live more energy independent or to secure them lifestyles for themselves. That can be like entry points for action, where you actually give people some agency back, which is very important, and especially in areas that are like more skeptical of progressive climate ideas. And that's a problem, that they're always labeled as progressive. It's important to get more into like conservative labeling of action that give agency back to people. I think that's an important entry point.
Just to come back to the Climate Assembly point as well around participation, there are different things you can get out of them. And I think it's important that not to think about the goal. I'm doing a little bit of work around impact evaluation. For example, if you look at the UK Assembly versus the French one, or the one that's happened in Germany, they were very different processes, but also you could use it to influence policy design. So you get rich data on how people are engaging with issues and what's important to them. And oftentimes what comes out of these processes is a list of principles. And these aren't things that change throughout the process. It's just people kind of reflect on what's important to them and how it applies to a particular issue. I mean, we already quite know a lot about these things, and top things that come out are things like fairness. People always think education is going to be important and so on. But if you want to use these processes to create kind of a social mandate or a conversation around the change that's required or what we might want to do, you need more than just the process. So we saw this in the French one. There was a broader national conversation, and it is a hard conversation to have, but there was a lot going on outside of just the assembly process. Whereas in the UK one, it was a very small, discrete event, but it wasn't used for broader conversations among the UK public.
So speaking of the social mandate, an issue that seems very high on politicians' agenda at the moment, and understandably so, is this of green lash. So we've seen what are perceived politically to be strong negative responses from the public around environmental policies. We also saw in the UK polarisation around the introduction of a ultra low emission zone, which is essentially an air quality measure, which played a role in a by-election in the UK and was then sort of used as this incendiary event to say that the public were against green issues. So I feel a bit divided over the issue of greenlash, and I'd really like to hear your thoughts on it.
I don't know all the specifics around, for example, what happened with the ULEZ zone and so on, but I do think there is a danger of it becoming what we would call like a discourse of delay, because it's no longer around denying that we need climate action, but it's about delaying climate action by a vested interest. And there are narratives out there about not having to do that much, or it costs too much, or the public don't want it. And to some extent, I think, you know, you have to think about whether these issues are coming up, because there generally hasn't been very good engagement with how people feel about the issue and what matters to them, or it's just poor policy design, or it is politicians using a small pocket of opposition to further their political career. So I think, I don't know the specifics of all of these issues, but I think we have to be careful about getting into this narrative around backlash, because people already don't necessarily know that other people are also really concerned about climate change. And it kind of feeds into this kind of, it reduces our agency and our feelings of collective efficacy if we think everyone is against these issues. So I'm a little bit concerned about making a big deal about backlash when in fact there might not be that much backlash.
Yeah, I think this really just goes to highlight the importance of narrative. And of course, one's identity gets linked to narrative as well as one's values and ideologies, whether you perhaps averse to policies that are perceived to be more coercive or restrictive of your freedom, for example, as a matter of core principle rather than the specifics of the policy. And that's not to say that that view is necessarily illegitimate, but of course it can get very muddied with either exaggerated narratives or misinformation, or as Christina says, vested interests who perhaps leverage those narratives. But I think it is important also to recognize that there are going to be genuine, legitimate reasons to object to some green policies, particularly where a particular quarter of the population might perhaps be unfairly affected. And Christina already mentioned the importance of fairness in policy. That obviously needs to be given a lot of attention, because it can be that a relatively small minority whom are negatively affected by policy could well be enough, and perhaps even justifiably so, to derail a green agenda. But of course, there are more and less effective ways to design policies that are fair. And so I think there's a whole body of work that needs to be done. And actually, we're starting to do some of this work ourselves in BIT. Around, if you take the sort of the short list of flagship policies that are likely to be required in some shape or form over the coming decades, you know, some kind of phase out of gas boilers, some kind of phase out of combustion vehicles, maybe something around diet change that might even, heaven forbid, include some kind of taxation, something on aviation to reduce excessive flying, etc. You take that sort of short list of policies that everyone's talking about and that are quite contentious, and then take some of the principles that Christina's outlined, like around fairness. Other ones are like the perceived efficacy of a policy. If people perceive it to be effective, they're more likely to support it. And try and integrate them into the policy to create a better version of that policy. So maybe rather than just, say, banning the sale of new combustion vehicles in 2030 or 2035, which is a little bit contentious, maybe you put some sort of additional cast iron consumer guarantees on that policy so that, you know, the minister could say, well, that is happening, but it will only be implemented if we meet certain price conditions such that at the time EVs are cheaper to buy and run than combustion vehicles, for example. And that's very likely to be the case come 2030 or 2035. So it's not a great threat to the delivery of that policy to say that, but it can offer the kind of reassurances that might help address some of the negative perceptions and narratives and fears and perceived risks that are perhaps currently, you know, at risk of thwarting or slowing down that kind of policy commitment.
I would like to pick up one thing that Christina says about that. It became more acceptable in Western democracies to build your, advance your political career on polarization issues. And I think that's one of the problems here, that actually some politicians jump on these issues because they can perceive a personal advantage here. That's like speaking much more general about the political culture and what's acceptable here. And in addition to the fairness issue, I think there's a value issue here. So it's not only about the design of political interventions, but it's also about like who it is addressing in what kind of setting with what kind of language. And the unfortunate thing is that too much of the climate issue has been framed in like a more urban liberal setting, when in fact it is about everyone. And especially actually also more disadvantaged communities would probably profit much more from climate policies if they're designed. Then it becomes important to more generally design the narrative of climate policies around like values that speak to a broader public. I think that's a very important point here.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And we already know that public support is contingent on delivery of co-benefits, and actually it motivates actions a lot more in some circumstances than concern around climate change. So, for example, if it has co-benefits around health and obviously cost saving. I think there's just another point that I wanted to pick up on around fairness. I mean, it's a complicated issue and a complicated value, and everyone will have a slightly different version of fairness, which often comes out in these deliberative processes, actually. But two things. I think Toby already talked a lot about distributional fairness and this idea that policies shouldn't disproportionately affect different groups, or we have to think about the distributional impact on different groups. But then also this point about procedural fairness. And you can design the best policy, but if you don't communicate it properly and you don't speak to the values or what's important to people, and it fits in with how they see their lives, and you don't engage them on how the kind of policy came about or how it might be implemented, then that's also where green lash might come from. So it's about distributional, but also procedural fairness.
Maybe one other quick point to add, and I'm sort of stealing from research from Christina's colleagues here, and I don't know if you were involved in this research, Christina, but public opinion is not some static obstacle that we need to navigate our way around. It's very dynamic, and it sort of operates in a bit of a feedback loop with political rhetoric. So if politicians talk about something a lot, let's say immigration, for example, then the public will tend to start to care more about it because they perceive their leaders as caring about it. And then vice versa, because the public are perceived to care about it, politicians will talk about it more. So you sort of get this sort of positive feedback loop going. And at the moment, there is not that much chat in political circles about net zero, certainly not enough. And actually, if politicians demonstrated bolder leadership on this issue and actually signal that it is really, really important, chances are the public would actually start to genuinely believe it is more important because their leaders are saying so. And so that could also create more of a useful feedback loop that would create a bit more of a social and political license to operate in this space.
Yeah, the political polarization of net zero is really troubling, I think, because that conversation with the public about how climate change will affect them hasn't really been had. So this kind of willingness to listen to public objections over net zero policies, I think, contrasts with a willingness to have those open and honest conversations with the public about the damage and the difficulty that they will face as a result of climate change. I don't think the two are being treated in the same way. And I think that, yeah, that is an area of concern. You touched on co-benefits, Christina, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about those. So, Felix, this is one of my favourite parts of the AR6 Working Group 3, Chapter 5, which you led, was this discussion about how in rich countries, the kind of changes needed to bring our lifestyles in line with carbon budgets actually can often have a positive impact on well-being. So I'd like to just unpack that a little bit and learn a bit more about what those kinds of co-benefits are, but also talk about this idea of values and what we aspire to and how that might change positively so that these shifts don't necessarily seem like deprivations. They seem like working towards something that we actually might find better than the status quo.
Yes. So what we did in IPCC, we related the policies and measures to well-being, what we call well-being. So 18 different metrics of well-being, including, for example, air quality, water quality, sanitation, infrastructure, public participation, social cohesion, and health, and others. And what we found that in most dimensions, there is a, if well-designed, co-benefit, so to say. So one important thing is it relates very much to the Sustainable Development Goals, especially the first 9 of them, which are very much coded in terms of well-being. So can align very well. It can create synergies between sustainability and climate action. And what are the major ones? I think it's important to understand that the literature is very biased in the sense that the health community, the medical community is very, very good. So there's a lot of very good studies. And we understand that actually health benefits are very strong and there is very good evidence of that. So let's focus on those because I think they actually relate to others as well. And there are 3 classes of action that make a lot of difference. The first is like air pollution. So like just getting away from fossil energy usually reduces air pollution, improves air quality. And that's like millions of lives saved every year globally. Second one is active mobility, like shifting from private motorized transport to private non-motorized transport. Let's include pedelecs because you're actually quite active on them too, like cycling, pedelecs, walking. That's major health benefit. You'll increase life expectancy so much by that. That's important. Actually, you can't just say, okay, let's do that. People just don't do it, but you have to make it easy for them to do it. And that's the urban design issue. And the third one is dietary shift. Like we know that red meat, which is mostly pork, lamb, and especially beef, is inducing cancer in the digestive system and has also impact on other health risks like diabetes indirectly. It reduces life expectancy quite a bit. So if we have much reduced consumption of red meat, that actually improves life expectancy again. So you have 3 classes of action that are just good for oneself, for myself, for yourself. And that's a very direct way to go forward.
One sort of detail I would maybe add on to the co-benefits comment, and I'd be interested in your views on this as well, because I've not done huge amounts of research on this, but it strikes me that where the co-benefit is a public good, such as improved air quality and so on, that might lead to an increase in support for a policy that delivers that public good. But would it necessarily lead to a change in my own behaviour? Probably there's a sort of weaker motivation there, in a sense that would I buy an electric vehicle because it fractionally improves air quality in my city? Perhaps not, because there's essentially a tragedy of the commons there. So when you're talking about individual action rather than support for policy, that co-benefit ought to ideally be felt at the individual level as well. So yes, I might be able to buy an electric vehicle because it saves me money because it's cheaper to run, for example. So I don't know if you've seen that distinction in the analysis you did, Felix.
That's completely true. Like the co-benefits in terms of public well-being don't necessarily translate directly into like action by individuals. So that's a different question of how to design those. But you're right, like inversely, like the food issue and the active mobility issue are both where individual benefits directly accrue. So you can actually motivate people easily or more easily in this domain.
It also speaks to having multiple different policies packaged together to enable both the social and the individual benefits. I just wanted to add as well around co-benefits, we've done quite a lot of visioning work with the public in our research. So for example, imagining what your city looks like in the future and what a person or creating people who might live in that city. And even though oftentimes they are framed initially around climate change, they all become about the co-benefits, those visions. They become about living in communities that are more cohesive, where it's easy to get around, that have clean air, and there's lots of green spaces. So, you know, I think the co-benefits really speak to people's kind of aspirations around how they want to live. Obviously, it doesn't necessarily mean that then it's easy to change your behavior. I mean, this conversation is making me think I really need to cycle more. But I'm trying to think about how to do that.
It's making me think I need to plan my boiler replacement. But I might have been thinking about that already.
Well, on that point, and maybe just to drive this point home, we've done some experiments on exactly this, looking at what kind of messages and narratives increase willingness to take on a heat pump. And maybe unsurprising to us in this room, but a little bit counterintuitive, is that the environmental message, you know, it's better for the environment, was by far the worst performing message. A few reasons for that. Firstly, it's not the strongest motivator. Doing something that's good for the environment is often a sort of nice to have in a consumer's mind rather than the top priority. But also it's the one thing that people know about heat pumps. You know, if there's anything people know about heat pumps, is that they're being pushed on us because they're better for the environment. So messaging on that basis is not really adding much knowledge to people. Whereas messaging around the co-benefits was much more effective. So in particular, that it will increase the value of your property, that it sort of future-proofs your property, that it might increase the energy security of the nation. So that's a sort of public benefit, interestingly. And also that it's effective. So sort of trying to flip on its head this narrative that they don't heat your home very well because they're operating at a lower temperature, and explaining that actually that gives a very nice sort of consistent level of ambient comfort. Those kind of messages were significantly more effective than talking about the environment.
Just to add to that point, I completely agree with Toby, and I think there's quite a lot of communication research also on other types of framing or framing around technologies or policies that would corroborate that. I wanted to just mention briefly, we also did some work on decarbonisation of heat and public attitudes towards that, and we did have a little bit of a trying to probe people's initial attitudes to see if we could change them by giving them a bit more information, like, oh, their grant, like what if there were grants, or, and so we had positive and negative messaging, and we generally found that those who already had negative attitudes, the negative information made them even feel even more negative, and the positive didn't really make them more positive, and the other way around. So your prior attitudes essentially informed how you took that information, which again is a very common psychological phenomenon. But it also suggests that these are still so unfamiliar technologies.
Which in a sense is kind of a blessing in disguise, because we see that there are quite a few negative narratives around heat pumps. As I mentioned, you know, they don't heat your home properly, they don't work in cold temperatures, they're really, really expensive to run. Of course, some of these things have a grain of truth in them. But actually, I think these misperceptions or these more negative stereotypes, they're quite lightly held at the moment because people just don't know. And people recognize they don't know. We've done surveys asking people literally, do you think you know anything about heat pumps? And only, you know, about 27% of people or so say they do know about heat pumps. And yet, despite recognizing the lack of knowledge they have, they're still quite happy to say they agree with these more negative sort of narratives. But, you know, I think it's not too late yet to change those narratives, because that knowledge is quite nascent, but we do need to get in there quick before those negative opinions really take root.
Well, and create the policies to make sure there isn't a lot of examples of, oh, your neighbour had a bad time. At the moment, we do find that, so on the same survey, we found that just knowing one other person who had a heat pump made you more willing to want to have a heat pump. So which kind of, and actually I think this is very preliminary analysis, but I think it also reduced concerns around reliability and cost, which suggests that if you know someone who's made it work, you perhaps believe that they could be reliable and are not going to break the bank. Obviously, these are still early adopters, though, and early adopters tend to know each other. So we have to think about what that means when it moves into other population groups.
Thank you. It's been a really interesting conversation. And I think conversation is kind of the word of the day, really, because I think if we can have that conversation, the benefits are potentially huge and potentially beyond just climate change, which obviously is not a just thing. But without those conversations with the public, which might sometimes be uncomfortable, it's really hard to see how the commitments that governments have made under the Paris Agreement, and hard to see how those interventions that we've heard about today might get put into practice. So I think that's my takeaway, is that we need to talk more about climate change with people and about these options and build those stories of a potentially better future in a way that people can really buy into, because the benefits are potentially massive. So thank you very much to my guests, Christina Dembski.
Thank you for having me.
Felix Kreitzig.
Glad to be here.
And Toby Park.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that concludes our climate briefing for today. It's been exciting to carry on our conversation from the Chatham House Energy Transitions Conference in the studio. To find out more about our conferences and events, please visit chathamhouse.org/events. To read more from our experts or to find out more about us, or to become a member, and we'd love to have you, don't forget to visit our website, chathamhouse.org, where you can follow the work of all our programmes, including our Environment and Society Centre. Goodbye from me, Ruth Townend, and thank you for listening.